Welcome back to Hoxton Square. With hot summer travels and leisurely holiday reading behind us, we thought this might be an interesting time to reflect on landscapes and writing a bit closer to home. So in the first of an occasional series on writing about place, we're going to discuss the life and work of a Scottish poet and novelist and his native landscape in the Orkney Islands. Editors Gail Perkis and Hazelwood are here. Hazel, this is George Mackay Brown. Now, he's one of the great 20th century Scottish poets and novelists, Booker Prize nominated. A fascinating character, but not a name that everyone will know. Why did you want to talk about him?
Well, one reason is I think that he was very reclusive. He lived on Orkney all his life. I think he went to London once. And his writing is fascinating because it's very, very local and it evokes that particular landscape wonderfully well. He was able to go very deep. So he's, in a way, past unknown, but he was a most fascinating character. I think it'll be very interesting to talk about him.
So before I introduce our guests, I'm going to hand over to Jenny Harrison-Bunning and Anna Kirk to catch up on what's happening here at the magazine right now.
Well, the office is absolutely full of boxes, again, because we've had delivery of the new season's issue and the books. And new this quarter, completely new, is our series of Rosemary Sutcliffe's Roman novels. So we've got the first two, The Eagle of the Ninth and The Silver Branch, and they're absolutely glorious looking. So I've had lots of fun photographing them. They've got fantastic coloured cloth, you know, oranges and bronzes and browns. And I've been making these little sort of short video clips for the website and for Instagram and all of our sort of social platforms, and they're great fun to make. So I just take a series of stills and then Anna and I hunt for rousing music that we feel befits the series. And
it's a lot of work,
yeah,
isn't it?
But they go down well, and I think people, you know, we're lucky enough to be able to use all of these platforms to promote what is essentially a very traditional looking thing, but actually it translates really well and people love the kind of vintage look of it all. And the autumn issue of the magazine is now out, and that's been a complete disaster for my reading list, which Anna knows because, of course, she proofreads the issues.
Yes, I get my reading list way ahead of time, so I'm very prepared. So, yes, I mean, there's lots to be recommended in the autumn issue. My particular favourite was Morag McInnes's article on Florence Marion McNeill's The Scots Kitchen. So although it's a cookery book, it's just fascinating social history, memoir, and also it's been just reissued with some really beautiful woodcuts, so it's a treat.
That's on my reading list too. And I've also got Olivia Manning's Balkan trilogy and a Penelope Fitzgerald short story, and then Dorothy L. Sayers' Gaudy Night, which I actually read a few years ago, but it was such fun, and the article's actually such fun that I'm just going to have to pick it back up, and the two Roald Dahl memoirs. Boy is the first one, and that's out now. And then Anna's working on the proofs with Gail and Hazel of Going Solely.
Yes, we're just wrapping up on those proofs now, ready to send to Smith's Hettle for Christmas. But yes, I'm having a lot of fun. I'm learning a lot about RAF squadrons, the Battle of Athens, and various different species of snakes in Africa.
Yeah, in fact, I'm so sorry, because we've now said Christmas, and I know it's September, and that might be quite early, but in the office, I think generally if anybody mentions it early January to March, they get shot down pretty quickly. But actually after that, it's kind of in our minds.
It's that soon.
Already. Yeah, and then, you know, by June, it really is Christmas time already. Not only thinking about our own titles, but also other books to recommend, and they go into the winter catalogue, and then, you know, Hattie and Jess are stocking up on wrapping paper, they're ordering rolls and rolls of our lovely sort of cream ribbon. So if anybody is super organised and already wants to do their Christmas shopping, they'd be very welcome. The winter issue comes out a little bit earlier than usual, and I know that Gail and Hazel have been, I think, are you putting that to bed now?
It's just about to go into proof, and we've got one more article to come in, but we've already decided what's going in. The next thing is to decide what goes where, and I'm in the middle of doing the picture research for it. We've got an article about Fanny Craddock, who was the most extraordinary cook.
I remember Fanny
TV
Craddock
cook.
My childhood.
And we found this glorious picture of her. It's part of the Angus McBean Theatre collection. She's there in all her glory with the most extraordinary hat, and then this confection in front of her, which is obviously some sort of Christmas decoration, which is, you can't believe it's actually made out of food, but it is. So that's going to go in. And we've got some very nice articles and quite a lot of humour as well, because we always feel that Christmas needs to be particularly jolly.
Well, before you two actually disappear back to your kind of day jobs, as it were, what are you both reading right now?
Well, I've actually just picked up a collection of short stories because they're so good to just kind of dip into. So I'm reading Atrib by Ellie Williams. It's published by a small press, Influx Press. Came out, I think, a couple of years ago. 17 short stories, and they're like little micro dramas and very domestic in subject. But Ellie Williams, she's very interested in language, words, dictionaries. She's written very entertainingly on dictionaries in the past. And so she just loves words. So it's full of linguistic tricks and it reads in places like prose poetry.
And the title again was?
Atrib.
Jenny.
I'm actually reading the last book in a trilogy that I said I was reading last time, which is Rebecca West's Cousin Rosamond, which is just absolutely fantastic, and I can't recommend the trilogy highly enough. But I actually want to recommend another book set on Orkney, which is Amy Liptrot's memoir, The Outrun. And I discovered her writing on this fantastic blog called Caught by the River. And then Anna and I went along to a Gladstone's library evening and we heard her reading there. And after that, I read her memoir, The Outrun. It's a sort of story of her recovering from alcoholism, and she retreats to her parents' farm on Orkney, and she wild swims and she maps the stars, and she goes off to one of these RSPB bird. Anna, you did one of those actually, didn't you?
Well, you can go and volunteer. Yeah, it's just a way of switching off from modern life for a
bit. Sounds great.
So yeah, highly recommended.
Thanks both. We will have autumn book recommendations from everyone else later on. And if you've never quite felt strong enough to tackle James Joyce's bewildering last work, Finnegan's Wake, stay with us. We have an extract from an archive essay all about it, which we are confident will help to unlock what's been called one of the most difficult works of fiction ever written in the English language. And trust me when I say it's a genuinely fabulous reading. So, something of a Celtic theme this month, and I'm delighted to welcome our guests, Maggie Ferguson, author of The Life of George Mackay Brown, and Colin Waters of the Scottish Poetry Library. Thanks so much for coming in.
Not at all.
Thank you for having me.
So, I did a bit of research into George Mackay Brown, because I have to say he was new to me, and it made grim reading. So, I've got born 1921 in Stromness in Orkney, family background of poverty, depression, possible suicide. George, obviously himself, lifelong mental illness, tuberculosis. It didn't sound great. It gave me a sense of real grimness, but that's not right, is it?
Well, it's not the whole story. No, he was immensely witty, a brilliant raconteur, very, very good company when he was in company in which he felt relaxed. And he wrote with great joy. I think while he was actually writing, he always felt very happy. So he wrote every morning after breakfast until lunchtime, and all his troubles were sort of held at bay. And then the clouds descended when he stopped.
So when did you first meet him?
I met him in 1992.
And you went to interview him?
I went to interview him for the Times, and it didn't go so well. I had various questions for him, which I thought might take up a good hour. And he answered them with yes and no.
The journalist nightmare.
That was all. and then after a while, when it was clear that I'd run through my questions, he just leant back in his rocking chair. He had a rocking chair in his sitting room he always sat in. And he began to hum. And it was one of my kind of earliest freelance pieces of journalism. So I was quite young. I was about 23 or something. And quite terrified and wondering what on earth I was going to say to my editor when I got back home.
So what did you do?
But fortunately, the next day, I bumped into him and he asked me if I'd like to come round for tea because he had a lot of friends coming round. And then he was just completely different, very relaxed, very funny. And as I was getting ready to leave his flat, he lived in a little council flat, he said he'd love to show me something. And it was the manuscript of a letter written by Mary, Queen of Scots, to her cousin, the King of France, the night before she died. And it was in old French. And I said, I'm really sorry, but I can't follow that at all. And he said, no, I'm not expecting you to read the French, but I thought you would be interested to see the firmness of her script in the face of death. And that was the beginning of a friendship, a great, great friendship for the next 4 years till he died.
For people who haven't been, who don't know it, don't have a real sense of what it's like or where it is, can you just give us a picture?
Well, I think the best single word to describe Orkney is the one that was used by Edwin Muir, the poet, also an Orcadian, which is fluent. It's low, but it's not flat. There's one very mountainous island, but otherwise there aren't big mountains.
And it's an archipelago.
And it's an archipelago. So there are 70-odd islands, and it's very, very rich farming land. After coming through the north of Scotland, which is quite barren, it's like the land of milk and honey, almost.
So this, I'm guessing, is Free Kirk territory. And so there was no alcohol when George was young, is that right?
There was no alcohol when George was a small boy, and then it was allowed again.
And I hear, Colin, he took to it in quite a big way.
Yes, he did. He had a reputation, or was developing a reputation at one point, for being the local soak. I mean, it's not unusual for Scottish poets. I think it's quite heartening, actually, the way in which literature offered him a pathway out of that kind of fate. I mean, his health was terrible from an early age. He had TB. He wasn't really expected to live beyond 30, and so people didn't really expect much of him as he was growing up.
Quite liberating.
Well, I think so in the end. I mean, he started to find his way when he was writing a column for the local newspaper, which is interesting to me because I used to be a journalist, and my first job was being a columnist for the Scottish edition and the Big Issue. And after about 3 or 4 weeks, I completely ran out of anything to say. And he managed to do it for years.
Did it till he died?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He must have just had such an intrinsic interest in life.
He was quite otherworldish, wasn't he? He was at odds with modern life, I think was the phrase I saw on your website.
Yes. Although the poetry is very much George Mackay Brownish and reflects his interests, he isn't a poet who talks about himself much in terms of I. The word I doesn't appear much
Never.
In his poetry.
I don't think there's a single poem with I in it. Somebody once described him as a poet who wrote with involved detachment, and I think that's absolutely it, because you can feel him there, but he never speaks in the first person.
And what did he write about?
Well, he wrote about Hamnavoe, which was his name for Stromness.
His hometown.
He wrote about the past of the Orkneys. For him, the past was very much present. He lived in the past, and the past lived in him. So the Vikings and the continual waves of immigration to the island were something that he dwelt upon. He was interested in religion. And
this is Catholic.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that really interests me, because he converted relatively trauma-free, because in certain other parts of Scotland, if you converted to Catholicism, that was, you know, a bit of a thing.
It was a strange thing. I mean, the number of Catholics in Orkney could probably have been counted on the fingers of both hands.
I think before we go any further, we need to hear some of the works, don't we? Hamnavoe?
That's his big hit.
Go on. Give us a couple of verses of Hamnavoe.
To give some background on the poem, it takes his father as a starting point. His father was a postman, and that's a good excuse to travel with him about the town, seeing the sights. The kirk, in a gale of psalms, went heaving through a tumult of roofs, freighted for heaven, and lovers, unblessed by steeples, lay under the buttered bannock of the moon. He quenched his lantern, leaving the last door. Because of his gay poverty that kept my sea-pink innocence from the worm and black wind, and because, under equality's sun, all things wear now to a common soiling, in the fire of images, gladly I put my hand to save that day for him.
Buttered bannock of the moon. It's pretty gorgeous, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that you can hear in the line about the black worm a great Dylan Thomas influence.
So, even though he sounds like an isolated character in a very, very remote place, he was highly regarded by his contemporary writers, wasn't he? He showed up in Edinburgh, didn't he, in the end? Late, when was that? 30-ish?
Late, he was 35.
Studying, and met the literary crowd.
Yes, who all took to him. We're talking about Norman McCaig and even Hugh McDermott and Sawley MacLean and Ian Crichton-Smith, a sort of amazing constellation of poets in 60s Scotland.
And George fell in love.
And George fell in love with a girl called Stella Cartwright, who was very much loved by all those poets and was known as the Muse of Rose Street. That, unfortunately, was a rather sad story. They did, in fact, get engaged, George and Stella, but the engagement was broken off, partly, I think, because George knew he never would have enough money, partly because Stella would never have been happy in Orkney. She was an Edinburgh girl. And partly because the two of them drank together and things got quite nasty when they drank together.
Right.
So, but they kept very much in touch, and their correspondence until Stella's death in the 80s is one of the most remarkable and deeply moving in Scottish literary history, I would say. And I was lucky enough to... It was all in a box, sealed up, when I started working on my book about George. And the librarian came over one day and said, I have something you might like to see. And it had, this box had a sign on it saying, not to be read for the time being. Very strange.
That's a great place.
But he agreed to let me open it, and there was this kind of treasure of letters.
Wow. Did you have the other side of the correspondence?
Yes,
well?
I then found the other side of the correspondence in a different library.
Perfect.
Yes. It was a sad story, but unbelievably beautiful.
And he wrote poems to her, as the Stella
And he
poems.
Wrote lots of poems for Stella.
Do you have one for us?
I have. I've got an acrostic poem he wrote for her. This is one of the last poems, not long before she died. He uses the letters of Stella Cartwright to form the first letters in each line of the poem. And he writes, so once in the 50s, there was this crazy chap, high among clouds, Edinburgh bound. Laurel-seeking he was, out of Orkney, long and salt his throat among the stanzas that starred the House of Rose Street. Could he not bide forever in that beautiful city? A sweet girl one day rose, a star, to greet him. To him, she was sweeter than rain among roses in summer, while poets like columns of salt stood round the oak Abbotsford bar. I now, going among the grey houses and piers of Stromness, hear that voice made of roses and rain still, and see through the storm clouds the remembered star.
It's so poignant.
Yeah, it makes me want to cry.
Yeah.
So he was fated by his counterpart writers. He remained in Orkney and resisted the lure of going south and becoming well-known and building a following. But from what I've read, he had a sense that poets and writers weren't anything special and shouldn't be lauded. Is that right? That they were just like anyone else, a plumber or a builder or...
That's absolutely right. I mean, he thought they were no more special than any kind of craftsman. He never gave a public reading of his work. He wasn't really that interested in reviews. But in an interview once, he was pushed about who he wanted to be writing for, and he kept saying, you know, he wasn't interested. Eventually, he said that he had five or six friends whose opinion he valued very much, and that if they liked his poetry and if their descendants liked his poetry and were still reading it in 200 or 300 years' time, then he would be very happy. So that is an absolutely massive ambition, much more ambitious than having, you know, a quick bestseller.
So just now, that heartback contact thing you were saying about, you know, being part of a continuum, you know, from the Norse myths and...
Absolutely. I mean, it's utterly in keeping with his character that he would be thinking 200 or 300 years ahead, because he's also at the same time thinking 200 or 300 years back. But I mean, you shouldn't think of him as some sort of character ambered in history. I think in some ways there's really interesting modern touches to his work. So there's that early poem where he takes the mickey out of the idea of racial purity. He has a doctor speaking who's an incomer to the island, who really just laughs at this idea of, you know, an island with a sort of true blood kind of population. And when I was rereading that poem, I was thinking, oh, it's very modern. And, you know, if you read Greenville, his first novel as well, there's an Indian character in that. And I don't think his sense of island life was one that was enclosed. To me, at least, it felt like a more confident take on island life, one that looked outwards.
I would completely agree with that, yes. I think he felt very strongly that by drawing his boundaries around him very tightly, it gave him the freedom to go travelling in his mind way back in the past and into the future, and Orkney became a sort of microcosm of the whole world for him. And he couldn't travel anyway. He was very, very agoraphobic. He sometimes could barely leave his house to go and, you know, buy a pint of milk.
Tell me about Greenville. That was the first novel, is that right? It's described as one of the great prose poems of the century.
I first read it when I was 14. I had to read it as a set text. And although it's been many years, I really remember it vividly. The structure of it, the characters, Ivan the ferryman, who's really a horrible character, but very memorable. There's an alcoholic, I think, who drinks methylated spirits.
Yeah.
Not so much at the time, but now I think it feels very drawn from life. And so there you have a real sort of recommendation for what island life and living really deeply in your setting can do. It can give you these characters who are very much themselves, but they feel like archetypes as well. And I could imagine a reader in South America or in the Scandinavian countries reading Greenville and having the same sense of recognition, you know, that I had even as a teenager.
Come across some analysis on Greenville saying that, you know, it was very prescient because it was talking about oil exploration, which was new in that region at that time, and the problems that would flow from that, which I'm imagining not a lot of other people were thinking about then.
That's what was very, very strange when the novel came out, and then very shortly afterwards the oil thing hit. It was prophetic. Yes. People were amazed that he'd seen this coming. He had an absolute instinct that something terrible was going to happen.
So later life?
Stella Cartwright died about 11 years before George, and he was so shattered by her death that he stopped being able to write. And to get himself out of that, he did write a memoir called For the Islands I Sing. That got things going again for him, and I think some of his most beautiful poetry was right at the end. His last book of poems, Following a Lark, was delivered to his council flat the morning he died.
Wow.
Yeah.
And, of course, he wrote this novel, didn't he, Beside the Ocean of Time, which was nominated for the Booker.
Maggie is right. You know, many writers don't go out on a high. They're not developing right till the end.
Yeah.
And with that last novel and with those last poems, there's no sign of a decline or a fade.
And what age is he then?
He died when he was 74.
And this is, what, this is the early 90s?
1996. It's a real watershed moment in Scottish poetry. The number of great writers who thought George Mackay Brown was, you know, their equal is astonishing. You know, Ted Hughes, Heaney, E.M. Forster.
Absolutely. Seamus Heaney, in fact, wrote me a long kind of letter about all his thoughts about George. The first collection of George's writing that he read, I think, was called Loaves and Fishes. And he was teaching in Dublin, and he ran into the common room, waving it above his head and said, this is the real thing. This is really it. Mm-hmm. And Hughes, yes, there's a letter from Hughes saying what a brilliant laureate George would have been. I mean, of course, he couldn't possibly have done it.
Yeah, I remember what he saying of the character, that doesn't sound...
No, he couldn't.
Man for the job.
I remember saying to him that he would have been a great poet laureate, and he just had this rather sly kind of smile, and he said, poet laureate of Orkney, maybe.
And it was an inspiration to other artists, wasn't it? Because there's the musician, isn't there, Peter Maxwell Davis?
Mm.
He based work on George's poems.
Masses of work on George's poems. They didn't work together, but I remember visiting George in his flat and there were some CDs sitting on a table next to him. I said, but George, you haven't opened them. And he said, actually, I don't have a CD player, but they're very good as beer mats.
Ah.
So
Peter Maxwell Davis was inspired by George, but George...
Maybe
was
not the
inspired.
Yeah.
Peter Maxwell Davis. Okay. Because I think it was his work, wasn't it? Farewell to Stromness was played at the funeral, wasn't it?
It was played at the funeral and it's played everywhere.
Do we feel he's been properly recognised for his work?
He's one of those writers who, if you mention him to people, either they know all about him and are very, very keen, or they simply have never heard of him. He's kind of, seems to me, he's one or the other for most people.
But Colin, you were saying in Scotland, everyone knows who he is.
He has a I mean, he's taught at school. So, you know, you grew up with him. I wish it were the case, and maybe it will be the case, that he'll become better known because we're about 2 years away from his centenary, and that seems to me a good moment to...
And Kathleen Jamie is editing a new collection of his poetry for that. So I hope that will get a wide circulation.
It does sound to me, Gail Hazel, you were ahead of the game, really, in bringing him to the fore.
I don't think we even really claim credit, but we did both work at John Murray, who published his later work, including his last novel.
Yes, he was very much of a sort of presence.
He was a presence, yes.
Although never
he
seen, of
No, of course, you presume you never met him.
Steph spoke to him.
The publicist here, actually,
yes,
and she was the one who nominated him for the Booker, I gather.
Well,
it
she would have
a mixed blessing, wasn't it?
Yes.
It was a bit of a mixed blessing. As soon, of course, as you're put on the Booker shortlist, media attention kind of descends on you. I don't suppose that many people, when they find themselves on the Booker shortlist, react by going to the doctor to get antidepressants. But that's what he did. But he was also drinking. So he was in a pretty bad way, and he was desperate for it all to be over. So, yes, it wasn't a particularly happy time for him.
Thanks, everyone. I'll be asking for reading recommendations a bit later on.
First, let's move on and hear this month's reading from the Slightly Foxed Archive. Now, Gail, this is about Finnegan's Wake.
It's another book that obviously has a very strong sense of place, in this case Dublin. It's a book I've never read. When this article arrived by Christopher Robbins, I thought, oh my goodness, does anybody really read Finnegan's Wake these days? I read the article, and by the end of it, I was convinced that this is a book that one should read.
Finnegan's Wake is a load of bollocks, isn't it? Forgive the crude critical assessment of one of the masterpieces of the 20th century, but it was a view I held many years ago. It was, however, a genuine question arrived at honestly. The book confounded me. Gobbledygook, gibberish, unbridled, incontinent, exhausting, professional Irishness. But God only knows what possessed me to put such a question to the Irish film director, Brian Desmond Hirst. More than 50 years my senior, he not only revered James Joyce, he had also known him in Paris in the 1920s. Brian did not answer at first. At length, he said, "That is your studied opinion, is it? That is your considered intellectual evaluation of one of the great books to have been produced by one of the greatest literary geniuses ever to have come from a race of great literary geniuses?" I began to backtrack. "Well, it doesn't make any sense. You can't read it. It's a formless loop of puns and wordplay. I mean, okay, Joyce is a great writer, but don't you think even Ulysses is overrated?" "It is generous of you to allow that Joyce has stature as a writer," Brian said at last. "However, we now descend from the brute assessment of Finnegan's Wake to the Philistine dismissal of Ulysses, one of the greatest and most influential novels ever written." Brian put his fingers together and closed his eyes as if in prayer. "The dairy woman crouching by a patient cow at daybreak in the lush field, a witch on her toadstool, her wrinkled fingers quick at the squirting dogs. They lowed about her whom they knew, dew silky cattle." Brian paused, opened his eyes to see if the words had found their mark. "As you will no doubt recognise, gems from Ulysses." "Nice," I mumbled. Brian took a deep breath. "In answer to your original question, you are wrong. Ignorantly, unimaginatively, enormously, Anglo-Saxonly wrong. Finnegan's Wake is music, it is song and laughter. It is enormously witty and madly clever. It is a great Irish writer's ecstatic expression of joy in the use of language. It is the endless dream of Ireland and all her history, a book for angels." The subject was dropped, and I never dared utter heresies about James Joyce again. 17 years in the writing, Finnegan's Wake impoverished Joyce, who lost his eyesight and his health during its composition. The book's eventual publication was met by almost universal bemusement. Even Ezra Pound, one of the earliest believers in Joyce's genius, found the book incomprehensible. Joyce took refuge in irony. "I've put in so many enigmas and puzzles that it'll keep a professor's busy for centuries." Sure enough, wave upon wave of scholarly code-breakers have brought their intellects to bear, offering interpretations from every possible perspective. More than 30 years after my conversation with Brian, I wrote a memoir of our friendship. On the point of completing it, I travelled to Ireland on a mission to take earth from the grave of his brother in Belfast, where Brian's ashes had been scattered, and mingle them with those of his sister on Howth Head, just outside Dublin. The evening before setting out for Howth, I dropped into a pub. As I stood awaiting a slow pint of Guinness, a man standing at the bar smiled and caught my eye. He was a skinny fellow with high, rosy cheeks and eyes that danced, dressed in a cheap, formless suit that hung from him. He began to speak. "River run past even Adams from swerve of shore to bend of bay brings us by a commodious ficus of recirculation back to Howth Castle and environs." The coincidence of the words struck me as incantation and omen. "I'm off to Howth in the morning to scatter an old friend's ashes." "When a friend was a friend in need to carry as earwigs do, they're dead," the man said. "They're soiled to the earth ball where indeed that we shall calm decline, our legacy unknown." "Finnegan's Wake?" "Taken from the sacred text itself," the man said happily. And the glory is that this night it did not fall on deaf ears. I smiled to myself, remembering the conversation with Brian so many years earlier. No any more? Reams of it. Page upon page. I drive people bloody mad with a recitation of it. I cannot be stopped. I'm a man obsessed with the beauty of the writing and the sound of the words and the humour and the wit and the endless play. Driven I am, seduced and bewitched. It's Finnegan's Wake that takes up my leisure hours, the reading of it and the reciting of it. I wallow in it, rejoice in it I do, shout it out in the bath. He's not joking, another drinker at the bar said. He knows more of that book than the Holy Father in Rome knows of the Bible, and that's God's truth. Thus prompted, the man found voice. Run over that Bible. In spite of all that science could boot or art could eke, bolt the grind and cave and can 'em. Single rex for the weak, double axe for the male, and quick quack quack for the radios. You will never have post in your pocket unless you have brass in your place. Mind the monks and their grasps. Scrape your souls. Commit no miracles. Postpone no bills. Practice preaching. Think in your stomach. Import through the nose. Let earwiggers wivable teach you the dance. The words rolled out natural and clear, and I listened with new ears. Enlightenment had finally come. Passages spoken aloud in an Irish accent released the book's power. Its beauty had been unlocked not by a literary intellectual, but by a half-type man in a Dublin pub. Finnegan's Wake was revealed as a work of sound rather than sense, a form of highfalutin Gaelic literary rap. Ireland talking in her sleep. It was as if Brian had taken me by the elbow and guided me into this particular tavern to receive a final Celtic benediction.
So Gail hasn't read it? I haven't read it. Has anyone round the table read it? Okay, I'm impressed. Oh. Colin's read it. If anyone would like to let us know how they get on with it. It was one for my retirement, that, possibly. That was an extract from Christopher Robin's essay on Finnegan's Wake. And the reader was the Irish actor, Rory Murphy. I don't know, were you with me, Gail, or Hazel in the studio when
yeah,
we recorded that?
I was there when Rory did it, and my goodness, it was impressive.
I hope he'll read for us again. Book recommendations from everyone shortly, but first, a word about the Slightly Foxed Quarterly magazine. Elegant and entertaining, Slightly Foxed is the literary quarterly for nonconformists. It introduces readers to all those wonderful books that languish on publishers' backlists but disappear from bookshops. Its contributors are established writers, journalists, and people from many fields. They all share their passion for particular books and authors, and since it's entirely independent, Slightly Foxed is free to follow its own nose and celebrate the offbeat. So why not take out a subscription? Happily, it's a bargain. £48 for a year's print subscription and free access to all the back issues in the digital archive. Here's the web address, foxedquarterly.com. Or if you'd rather talk to a human, give Hattie a call. She's on 020 7033 0258. Thank you. The dogs are visiting us, so be prepared for noise. I heard one of them snoring earlier. Did you hear when we were talking?
Chudley is nudging me under the table.
So. Okay, let's move swiftly on to recommended reads from everyone. Hazel.
Well, I've been enjoying a book by Hugh Walpole, who is virtually forgotten now, but he was incredibly popular in the 1920s and 1930s. The book is called Jeremy. It's about a small boy growing up in a cathedral town. Walpole's father was a vicar. And first of all, the atmosphere that he creates in this book and the effect the sort of calendar of the church and so on have on this small, rather rebellious little boy. It's astonishingly absorbing and sort of moving, actually. And it's really about growing up, set in the late 1800s, but it's really very modern. I think his psychology of Jeremy and how, in a way, grown-ups can never really see things from a child's point of view. And what a child means often is completely misinterpreted by the people around him, which in his case includes his father, who's too busy doing good in a general way to really be able to relate to anyone in particular. I think it's just a brilliant study, really, of growing up. It is actually a trilogy, and you see Jeremy going off to school and coming back and the excitement of coming home and what a letdown it often is when you're really looking forward to something. In a sense, it's dated, but actually, I think it isn't dated at all. I enjoyed it tremendously, and I think it's a great autumn read.
Gail.
I've just finished the sixth book in a series by Mick Herron, set in Clerkenwell, in a rather dingy building which is tucked between a Chinese restaurant and a newsagent. And the people who work there are the rejects from MI5 in Regent's Park.
Okay.
They are known as the slow horses, and they all have problems. One's a recovering alcoholic, another has some anger management issues. Somebody else has a gambling addiction, and they've been ousted from Regent's Park. Haven't actually been sacked, but they've just been sort of parked in this hideous office.
So what do they do?
Well, they work for a man called Jackson Lamb, who is utterly repellent physically. He's fat, he farts, he belches. He never has a kind word to say to them, but you know, nonetheless, that actually he'll do anything for them. And they do what spies do in novels. They pursue bad people. Sometimes they get killed. And this series, as I say, there are six books in the series so far. The first book is called Slow Horses. The one I've just finished has only just come out, called Joe Country. They're immensely entertaining.
They sound great.
They're kind of postmodern Le Carré, but yeah. I think they're funnier.
Maggie.
I have just been interviewing Richard Holloway, so I've been rereading his autobiography, or his memoir. He makes a distinction between those two things, Leaving Alexandria, which I think is one of the most moving and beautifully written memoirs I've ever read. I think it's a real masterpiece. It tells the story of how, as a small, very poor boy, he was sent to a seminary and was meant to be growing up to live a sort of monastic life, and he was absolutely in love with that kind of life, but then became a regular priest and was eventually Bishop of Edinburgh, and then began to lose his faith, or maybe he never quite lost his faith, but his, as he said to me when I interviewed him, faith and doubt play a descant to each other, and the tension between religion with its rules and individual lives and what people need and long for is really very wonderfully explored.
Colin.
Well, as I work at the Scottish Poetry Library, I feel I should recommend some Scottish poetry.
Absolutely.
Contemporary Scottish poetry. So I shall mention Neil Campbell's second volume of verse, which is called Noctuary, and it's currently on the Forward Prize shortlist. It's a series of poems about being a new and young father. I found a lot in it that was impressive in terms of technical ability, but also just the humanity and sometimes humour. Now that I've done that, I want to recommend another book. It describes itself as a psychological investigation of Trump. The format that takes, if you've read Shields' previous book, Reality Hungry, you'll be familiar with it. He has literary quotes, his own observations, transcripts from interviews with Donald Trump, and he creates this mosaic of the insanity of the Trump phenomenon. And I very much recommend this book if you want an alternative take on the Trump years.
I've got to say congratulations, because I think that is the most diverse bunch of book recommendations I've ever heard in any podcast, not just this one. As always, you can find details of all the books we mentioned today and all the writers, of course, in the show notes attached to the episode on your podcast app, or indeed on the website foxquarterly.com. Many thanks to Colin Waters and Maggie Ferguson for being here. We've loved having you.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed this foray to Orkney and hearing about one of its great writers, we'd be very glad to have your thoughts about where we might go next on this literary grand tour. We're after really good but lesser known or perhaps forgotten writers with a deep connection to their particular part of the world. So please do tweet, email, or take up a pen and write us a letter. We'll be back on October the 15th with a podcast about antiquarian and second-hand bookselling. Thanks for listening and for joining us on another bookish expedition off the beaten track.